John Etherton is president of Etherton and Associates and contributing to a series of essays for the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Permanent Subcommittee on Investigation, Senators Levin and McCain requesting input from over 30 acquisition community members, experts on defense acquisition reform, and looking at the question, where do we go from here? And Mr. Etherton, it's a pleasure to have you back on the program. Thank you for your time today. You write in your remarks to the subcommittee that successful acquisition reform will require evidence-based decision-making. Why do you think it's so important, and why was it the very first concept that you wanted to present to the subcommittee, John? Thank you for joining me today.
Sure, Francis. In my view, this is one of the major issues now that is different, sort of a different factor than what we've had in the past in terms of looking at acquisition reform. We have better access to data about performance of the acquisition process, and we also have better analytic tools to actually assess the data and understand what it means, put it in context, and use it as a decision-making tool rather than having to rely on anecdotes and people's hunches and things like that. So I think of all the things that I see out there that really characterized what could be a different approach this time on acquisition reform, I think evidence-based decision-making is probably the major thing.
Is it your sense that the Pentagon's leveraging that data, though, as effectively as they can and applying it in all the possible ways that they can do it? Or are we still kind of in a learning process or shakedown cruise in figuring out how it all applies?
I think we're in a learning process right now. I think if you look at the two recent annual reports on the performance of the defense acquisition system that Secretary Kendall's office released, I think you have an example there of good attempts to start to take the existing data, in this case the information that we have from major defense acquisition programs, and to try to derive some sense of correlations, at least, between different conditions occurring and outcomes. Those are important first steps. I think we really need to go well beyond that and really start looking at other different elements, activity costs, other kinds of things that would really give us a much better understanding of different acquisition policies and different acquisition strategies outside of those applied in the major defense acquisition program realm. So we're now just starting down that road. I think it will be easy to conceptualize what this should look like. I think implementing it will be a challenge, and it will take many years.
You write, the reports are admirably clear about what we can derive from their analyses and what requires further study. So it sounds like you are at least optimistic that we have a map, even if we are just starting down the road.
I do. I am. I think the real challenge, though, will be to see if we can collect in a meaningful way the data that we're already generating through our the new business systems that are coming online in the department and from other sources, to really take some of the analysis and some of the concepts beyond major defense acquisition programs, which are only about $70 billion of spending annually in a procurement budget that's roughly $350 to $400 million. So we really need to be getting better insights into other areas besides major defense acquisition programs in terms of what acquisition strategies are successful. Where do we put our resources on specific problems or issues on pricing or other kinds of things to get the most effective result?
You were a key player, experts tell me, in FASA, the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act of 1994, and Clinger-Cohen. You reference those and other efforts at acquisition reform in the 1990s in the comments that you made to the subcommittee, John, and you write, of all the reforms attempted by Congress and the administration during the 90s, arguably the least successful were those meant to transform the acquisition culture. Tell me what you mean there, and tell me where that effort went wrong, John.
Well, I think there were a couple of issues there. Number one, we were trying to sort of, you know, have less rule-based, less compliance-based acquisition decision-making. We wanted people to use judgment. We set up a number of pilot programs that would, you know, relieve decision makers of some of the requirements in either regulation or statute, and a lot of that really kind of went by the boards. And I think there were a couple of issues that we had not anticipated that we probably, had we thought about it, could have anticipated better. One is the fact that we really didn't change the way that we were assessing the performance of the process, so that the oversight community judging the effectiveness on a given transaction, and we tend to look at these things on a transaction-by-transaction basis, they really were using the more historic metrics. Did we pay too much on the price at this particular time? Did we follow all the standards for determining price reasonableness? There were a number of other issues that came up in that regard. And so I think the signal pretty, despite the very high-level cheerleading that we heard from a lot of the senior people at that time, I think the signal went out to the workforce that things really hadn't changed that much. And a lot of the pilot authorities were really never used. I think that combined with the fact that we cut the acquisition workforce in half at roughly the same time really did not allow for some sort of restructuring that would have allowed for some expanded use of judgment and other things as opposed to more of a rule-based approach.
So what I take away from your comments just a moment ago and the comments that you gave to the subcommittee is that there are two ways to send a message that we're serious this time about not just acquisition reform, but whatever it is we're serious about in the Department of Defense. And that is the very high level advocacy, as we're seeing Secretary Kendall and others making for some of the reform efforts that he's undertaking, but also putting money where mouth is, to use an old phrase, in providing the training and the other resources that are necessary to build the workforce in the way, to shape it in the way that you want it to go.
Well, I think there's another factor, too, that we need to consider, and that, again, going back to the evidence-based decision-making, I think if we are able to capture the data, really understand the context, really understand the things in a sort of a meaningful way in terms of performance, I think it gives us the opportunity to develop new concepts of value, frankly, that take us above the level of a transaction-by-transaction approach that might allow for consideration of the, sort of these broader trade-off of different factors in making acquisition decisions and setting up acquisition strategies, and I think and be able to support that with more of an evidence-based approach to justify where the value is. And I think, again, we're at a very early stage on this, but I think that different concepts of value and really trying to understand at a higher level where the effective trade-offs can be made in the interest of the taxpayer. That's a road we have to go down if this is going to be a different effort than what we've had in the past.
John Etherton's president of Etherton and Associates, making comments to the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations on Defense Acquisition Reform. I mentioned that some of your comments are based on some of the issues, the problems, challenges with defense acquisition reform in the 1990s, but you write some of those efforts were quite successful. You cite opening up the federal market to commercial items, simplified procedures for low-dollar procurements, many redundant, costly statutory requirements were eliminated. Are those efforts that could still work today, and are those efforts that could work without the need of Congress intervening? Are there things there, for example, that Secretary Kendall could take once he's finished with his regulatory review and take action himself in order to make this process work better?
Yes, I think, Francis, a lot of that things that could be done are within the administrative and regulatory authority of the department and the administration as a whole, not only for DOD but for the other federal agencies. I do think there is a role for Congress to play, though, because I think one of the clear messages that we got in the 1990s was that some of the legislation that we passed really didn't need to be passed. I mean, it basically said, go do things that you're authorized to do anyway. But it was the signal that there was broad congressional support to move in some of these directions, especially in areas where there might be some risks involved. And having Congress essentially buy into that process, it was fairly important. So it's my hope that Congress, in this new round, and there's everything I'm hearing from the Hill seems to indicate that we're moving down this road, but Congress will take sort of a partnership role in this and use their oversight and their other tools in their toolbox to sort of help this effort along. I think a legislative review probably is in order, similar to what we did with the Section 800 panel effort in the early 90s, to just sort of reevaluate, reassess statutes to see if they're working in the way that they were envisioned or whether, given the change conditions, whether we need to reconsider them. But I think a lot of what can be done without specific grants of authority in legislation.
You write about the requirements process, and the requirements came up in, I didn't read all 30 couple essays of comments to the subcommittee, but all of the dozen or so that I did read, everybody wrote something about requirements, and you did as well. Congress and the Pentagon should improve the requirements generating workforce. How do we do that?
Well, it's tricky because you're dealing with people who are in some cases inside what is considered the acquisition workforce and subject to a lot of the Defense Acquisition Workforce Improvement Act requirements and other requirements, and also eligible to take advantage of some of the resources that are available for that workforce. And then you have a lot of folks who are not officially in the acquisition workforce who are also key people in the requirements generation process. And you have this issue that goes all the way from very complex major defense acquisition programs to, you know, fairly standard services contracts at different levels. So it's a very disparate area, and it's a very tough one to get your hands around in terms of trying to understand what specific things should be done. It's not an area that I think, frankly, you can legislate and say do requirements better. I don't think that'll do any good. But I think understanding the people that are involved in that, the various organizations, the type of procurements that they actually directly influence with requirements, and trying to get a better understanding of that and how those various processes can be improved, I think will be an undertaking. But again, I think it'll probably take several years, but I think that's an area that we probably need to look at. This is not something that you're going to pass a law or fire a silver bullet and fix. It's very complex, but I believe, as others as well, that a lot of the issues we've had in requirements development are really things that then lead to a lot of problems downstream in the acquisition process.
You write, Congress should explicitly align the requirements, acquisition, and budget processes under the purview of the service chief and centralize accountability for service acquisition performance in the position of each service chief. Where are they misaligned right now, the requirements, acquisition, and budget processes, John?
Well, you have a situation where the service chiefs, and again, this is mainly in the major defense acquisition program area, they are involved through the various organizations that they work, such as the Joint Requirements Oversight Council and other groups in developing requirements. The frequent problem that you have is that at some point all of this gets handed off into the acquisition process, which is normally now managed on the civilian side of the equation in the department, and their role tends to diminish a little bit. And what we're trying to figure out is a way to not put them in charge of acquisition. That's not something that I think it would be a prudent move at this point, but to give them at least some greater role for a longer period of time within the acquisition process in terms of looking at requirements and what the trade-offs are in terms of funding and things like that, so that they're more involved at later stages in the process than they are now.
You write, one final lesson from past acquisition reform efforts is the great impact of boundary conditions on the success for any contemplated improvement. Define that term, boundary conditions, please, John.
Well, for me, that term denotes the various environmental factors that are not directly under the purview of the acquisition enterprise that really drive incentives and behavior within the enterprise itself. And those are things like the budget process, which is, you know, separate and apart from the acquisition process and governed by separate statutes and different folks in Congress and the agencies. You also have issues like the personnel process, which doesn't merely serve the acquisition process, but also all of the military on the operations side is really governed by the personnel process, and you know, people sort of move in and out of the acquisition world on the military side, at least, from that process. But these are things that are really somewhat outside the control and the direct influence of change to acquisition statutes or regulations or whatever, but are really things that drive the behaviors. And from my opinion, the budget process and the way we handle money probably has as great an influence on decision-making and incentives and really what drives some of the issues in the acquisition process as any other factor.
You write a number of times in your comments to the subcommittee, John, about the Weapons Systems and Acquisition Reform Act of 2009, WASARA. And toward the end of your remarks, you write, it serves as a good model for a rapid legislative process where complex issues involving multiple stakeholder communities are in play. What went right about WASARA? And given the environment that we're in today, which is admittedly more complex and maybe even worse than in 2009, can we duplicate today, can Congress duplicate the success that you saw with WASARA?
I think absolutely Congress can do that, and I think the elements of that process that should be emulated are the fact that the bill was introduced in February of 2009 as a freestanding bill. The Armed Services Committee and the Senate started the process. They had a number of hearings. The process was a relatively open process in that the staffs were always available for various parties to come and talk to them about issues. They gathered a lot of information and showed themselves to be, throughout the process, relatively sensitive to information coming in and clarifications and other things, not only from folks in industry, but also from folks in the executive branch. And that process was done relatively quickly because they basically introduced the bill in late February, and by mid-May it was passed as a freestanding bill with a House counterpart process to boot. So I think it's well within the capabilities of the Armed Services Committees and even a broader coalition of committees in Congress to duplicate that process again. The part of it that I felt was really sound was just that they were open to principled analysis and other kinds of arguments coming in, and you could see at each stage as the bill was considered there were various improvements made, and I think what came out at the end was something that was a very great collaborative effort from a lot of different parties, and they assessed the arguments fairly and I think came up with a fairly balanced product that had strong support not only from within Congress, but also with the executive branch and major sections of industry.
All right, flag this fact. The chairs of the subcommittee that you're commenting to are the were the sitting chairs at that time and still are today of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Senator Levin and Senator McCain. And so it sounds like the information that you're proposing is going to the right ears who could potentially move it forward, at least in the short period of time that Senator Levin will still be in the Senate. He's retiring at the end of his term.
Well, I honestly, I'm not very hopeful that we're going to see any major legislative initiatives this year. But I think as the committees embark on these issues, looking at these issues next year, I'm hopeful that they'll look back at their record and try to duplicate it again.
I agree with you. It is unlikely that Congress will do anything, any heavy lifting like this between now and the end of the lame duck session. But a fresh start in January could mean some significant optimism, I would think, for this effort.
I'm optimistic. We'll see how it all comes together. If we go back to the 1990s, you see a process that sort of started in fits and starts, but eventually it did all come together, and we did make some fundamental change. But I guess the one thought that I would say for everybody involved is patience is a virtue here, because if you go back to the 1990s and the process we started there, it was essentially a six-year process from start to finish, and I think an enterprise as complex as the acquisition process and trying to deal with some of these things that are driven by so many different influences, it will take us many, many years to do meaningful change.